I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas City, Kansas Fire Department answers more than 26,000 calls for service every year. Behind that impressive number is a department that has had disagreements with the unified government, faced station consolidation, and was called out for paying firefighters for shifts they didn't work. This summer, an outsider, Mike Callahan, became the department chief. Today, we'll ask him how he's addressing the challenges that came with the position. Then, the film critics will introduce us to the latest showings that include the Dames of English Acting, one rock climber's harrowing adventure, and the role that Robert Redford says is his last. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's been almost 2 months to the day since Mike Callahan took the reins of the Kansas City, Kansas Fire Department. He took the job knowing it would include some big challenges. Firefighters getting paid for shifts they didn't work. Accusations of inappropriate political activity. And some claims that they were harassing the old mayor. Not to mention the challenges facing any department in keeping aging fleets and stations up to speed. KCK Fire Chief Mike Callahan is here with us today to let us know how things are going so far. And Chief Callahan, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So you came to KCK after 40 years in the Chicago Fire Department. How are you enjoying Kansas City so far?
Very nice. We like it a lot. More importantly, my wife likes it.
That's, okay, that is
important. More important than whether I like it. Almost 40 years, not quite 40 in Chicago, though.
But the transition has gone smoothly. How different is the culture of the fire department here than in Chicago?
I think fire departments nationally are pretty much the same in a culture sense. We're a tradition-wedded entity. We as a service love. We don't like the way things are, but we don't want anything to change. That's the way the fire service is generally.
And so, knowing that from your experience in Chicago, you came here to Kansas City, and you said on your first day on the job that you had a 100-day plan. And I know it's only been 60 days, so we won't hold you to it quite yet. But what were the things you hoped to take on right out of the gate?
Many of the things in my 100-day plan have been completed. I wanted to meet with the command staff both individually and collectively. I've done that. A big part of my plan, and the most comprehensive part of my plan, is to visit every fire station on every shift to hear from the field what their concerns are about the department, what we do well, what we could do better. And I'm about 60% through that already.
Okay.
I've visited about 54, I've visited about 60% of the shifts and the houses.
And so you're hoping to make contact with everybody in the department before too long?
I will make contact with everybody before the 100 days is up, yes.
What else was in that plan? What do you still have to do?
I've met with my law enforcement partners, the sheriff, the police chief, the district attorney. I've done all that. Part of my plan is evaluating the condition of the physical facilities in the city. I've completed that. And evaluating the condition, placement, and categories of the department's apparatuses, their fire engines and fire trucks, that's ongoing. So that's going to take a little while longer, but we are doing that.
We got a lot of those questions individually to talk about, but if you had to give kind of an overall grade to the department as you've now sort of come in, you finally are getting a look at it from the inside. How's the KCK Fire Department doing in general?
I think they're doing very well. I think they're an aggressive interior attack department, which is important. They want to work. The need here is some structure, consistency, and discipline. Those are three things that not only are needed, but the firefighters are yearning for those.
And I gather that those would be things that you'd want any fire department to have, but your mentioning them makes me think that maybe they've not been in as full a supply as you'd like.
I would say that's an accurate assessment. I think they've also not been in as full of a supply as the firefighters would like.
We want to invite our listeners. If you have questions for KCK Fire Chief Mike Callahan, we would love to hear from you. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. If you're a firefighter, you're a taxpayer in KCK, what's important for you to know from the new fire chief? 816-235-2888. 2888. We're also on Twitter at KCUR up to date. Chief, you know, an enormous issue in KCK has been one raised by the previous mayor, Mark Holland, back in January about the practice known as shift trading. That's when firefighters who are assigned to certain shifts take them off, which they can do up to a certain amount, and others come in and work overtime. The reports earlier this year was that practice had cost the city almost $1 million for unworked shifts. Back in July, I talked with current Unified Government Mayor David Alvey about this on the program. Here's what he had to say.
I'm going to let the new fire chief investigate that, and his or her responsibility will be to come back to the commission with the report, do a comparison of what the practice is in other places. The bottom line is, and I've said this publicly, and I will continue to reiterate this, that when all this is said and done, we have to make sure that the fire department looks good, that the commission needs to look good, the mayor needs to look good, the fire chief, the union needs to look good, and we will all look good if we do well by our residents. That's our responsibility, and that's what will happen.
So obviously the mayor said this would be on your agenda. What's your take on shift trading in KCK?
All right. As some background, shift trading is it's a national standard in the fire service. There's no other industry, no other profession that goes to work for 24 hours at a time and picks their vacations a year in advance. So firefighters need the ability to trade shifts. It's just the way it is, and it'll continue to be that way. There are some subtle changes that I'd like to look at. Some of them are in the collective bargaining agreement, so I'm not going to bargain that in public. But there are some small tweaks that might need to be made to make it more efficient. However, shift trading as in general is something that will continue.
From the investigation you've been able to do so far, I mean, does it seem to you that anything illegal or inappropriate was being done, or is it just a practice that that maybe wasn't to the advantage of taxpayers in every case?
I don't believe that as a way of explaining shift trading, if you ask me to work for you and then you come back and work for me, it doesn't cost anybody any money. That's a zero-sum game. That's just the way it is. I don't believe that, without getting into the detail of what went on before I got here, I'm not so certain that it was costing the taxpayers the amount of money that it was alleged to have been costing them.
Maybe that was an exaggeration.
I won't use the word exaggeration, but I would say that there might have been some misinformation in there.
So even if it wasn't as much as perhaps was suggested in the study, if there was misinformation, as you say, you did mention there could be some tweaks in the name of efficiency. And without trying to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement on the air, what kind of tweaks are you talking about? Just tighter limits, more enforcement? What do you mean?
Moving to an electronic manpower program where trades can be tracked more efficiently so that they don't get lost in the cracks, where they're captured electronically and then maintained in a database, that would be one of them.
Do you think there's a way, as Mayor Alvey said in his comments on this program, that everyone can sort of come out, as he said, looking good on the other side of this?
Yeah, I believe that that's not only possible, but I believe that that's exactly what's going to happen.
Including even the firefighters themselves who will continue to practice shift trading in accordance with their contract.
That's correct.
It's been pretty well documented, too, that firefighters, at least some firefighters, harassed former Mayor Holland after he raised some of those issues. There was talk about blaring their sirens near his home at night, that sort of thing. Do you believe that happened?
I don't know. I'm not conversant enough with what happened prior to my arrival to make an informed opinion on that.
Is it something that would bother you if it turned out it did happen?
If it were true, yes, that would bother me. Firefighters shouldn't be harassing anybody, nor should anyone else.
So what do you do? And you're coming into a new place. You don't know these folks yet. What comes to mind as the ways that you as a chief would handle either getting to the bottom of that or setting a different kind of standard?
As I suggested earlier, I think we in the department are yearning for and lack a little bit of consistency and a little bit of discipline. I think that once those are in place, the consistency and the discipline, I think incidences like that wouldn't happen. And if they did, they would be dealt with.
You said earlier you think the firefighters themselves are longing for that as well. What's your relationship been with the firefighters and the union so far?
Thus far, I've had no problems. I've been welcomed with open arms, to coin a phrase, into the firehouses that I go to generally every night to talk. And I've spent a lot of time in there, up up to 6 hours at a crack after my work is done, just letting them tell me what they feel and where the direction of the department they see it going. So I think I've been welcomed. The union has been welcoming as well. I mean, obviously, our goals are the same. We want everyone to be safe, the residents and the firefighters. And there are going to be things we're going to disagree on. But when we can agree and move forward together collectively, we're going to do that.
There were some folks who said around the time you started this job, the Kansas City Star had an editorial that said the union is, quote, out of control. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I don't think that the union is out of control. I think the union's doing exactly what unions do. They're representing their members.
You worked your way up through the Chicago Fire Department, right?
I did.
You were part of the union.
I was. For about half my career, I was in the union, yes, Local 2.
And you think that sort of everyone has a role to play, and you're comfortable with how the KCK, Firefighters Union, is handling their role?
I am. I'm very comfortable with what they're doing. They're representing their members like they're supposed to.
You know, a lot of folks wondered about one particular challenge you might face, which is that when you applied for this position, there were six publicly named finalists. Two of them were internal candidates, presumably well-liked folks in the department who didn't get the job. Has that proven to create any difficulties for you?
Not at all. And as a matter of fact, during the organizational restructuring I'm doing, one of those individuals has become the first deputy fire chief, one of those finalists, and the other one has become a deputy chief. Both of those individuals were recognized and promoted into higher-ranking positions.
I want to invite our listeners once again at 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Let's talk about some of the other challenges you face, not necessarily controversial challenges. In fact, they're probably challenges facing most fire departments around the country. One of them is how to do everything you want to do with the limited funds that are available to do it. And one area where that comes up is with stations in particular. How are you tackling those kinds of questions about how to build the stations the city and the county need at this difficult moment?
Well, we have a plan, a 10-year plan moving forward to refurbish and rebuild fire stations. We're constructing one right now in the Piper area. It's at Hollingsworth, or excuse me, it's at Hutton Road and Leavenworth Road, and we expect completion of that fire station by 2019. And there are other fire stations that are currently being looked at for renovation or replacement. And as I said, that 10-year plan was developed prior to my arrival, but it looks like a workable plan.
And why is that important? Why is it important to have renovated fire stations in this moment?
Well, like I alluded to earlier, when there's no other profession that goes to, we live in the fire stations. They're our home one-third of our lives, so we sleep there, we eat there, and in addition to working there. So they need to be safe, they need to be warm, they need to be dry.
Yeah, I wonder what you would regard besides the buildings themselves as some of your top priorities going forward. I mean, there's a 100-day plan, but then there's probably a 3-month plan and a 6-month plan after that. Where do you go next?
I'm as I said, I'm meeting with my command staff. We've made some moves since I got there in terms of repositioning some of the apparatus around to provide better efficiency to the citizens. And there are plans to rewrite many of the general orders that need to be to be looked at. Some of them are quite old and they need to be redone, as well as getting new uniforms for the members. That they heretofore hadn't had.
Don't even think about that as being a big issue, but of course it is.
It is. The members below the rank of battalion chief don't have dress uniforms, and they should. When they're in formation in a parade or regrettably at a firefighter's funeral, they need to look professional, and they will.
You know, speaking of the firefighters themselves and questions of staffing, that's another area that's been a source of some controversy or at least concern around the city. How much do you think is needed in terms of change in that regard? How many firefighters should be on duty at each station? Do you have enough? How many firefighters on particular vehicles? Are those numbers where they need to be?
Well, it's quite a few questions. There's no fire chief in the country who is going to turn down additional firefighters, at least none that I know of, if they're offered. Right now, we're assessing that, our reliance on and our compliance with NFPA 1710, which is the industry standard for response times and manning on fire engines and fire trucks.
Yeah. And so say more about what that means. I mean, how far is KCK from those national standards, those goals?
They're not as far as some might believe. We're close. We're sending additional units to the scene of fires now to ensure that the appropriate number of personnel can arrive on the scene and begin initial extinguishment efforts at a fire. I think we're going to look more deeply into how to adjust our response methodology and protocols to ensure that that is done on a wider basis in the city.
One of the sources of some controversy that you've already had to deal with was a concern raised by one of the UG commissioners, Mike Kane, who suggested that the Piper area, where you mentioned a new station should soon be built, isn't adequately being staffed. When a pumper is out of the station, it had been replaced immediately by one from a different station. Now that is only happening if it's gone for more than 30 minutes. He expressed some concern about that.
Not if it's gone for 30 minutes, if it's expected to be gone for 30 minutes. We're leaving that in the hands of the professional dispatchers to make a determination as to whether the emergency response that pumper's going on is going to require them to be gone. The pumper that was going there, from a tactical perspective, from a fire service professional, was coming out of a busier area, about 224% more active in their territory. To move them out didn't make much tactical sense to me, so I stopped the practice.
And as a result, at least Commissioner Kane thought that Piper, which is, as for those who don't know, the neighborhood northwest of Kansas Speedway, around 123rd and Leavenworth Road, thought it wasn't being adequately served.
Right. Well, it's just one of the reasons we're building a new fire station out there, because of the population growth in that area. They need more fire stations in that area.
I know that another area of concern to fire departments across the country, and an area where you had particular experience when you were a deputy fire commissioner in Chicago, was with equipment. How would you assess the state of KCK's fleet of firefighting vehicles?
I think the fleet is it needs some replacement. There's some rigs that need replacement. The spare fleet, according to the NFPA standard, should be broadened. The apparatus, the frontline apparatus, they have a fairly robust cyclical replacement program that we're going to make sure continues. The Kansas City, Kansas Fire Department did in the early 2000s. They were one of the few departments in the country that met the NFPA standard for frontline apparatus, where all of their apparatus were 10 years or less old. We never met that in Chicago.
I wonder, too, about money when it comes to equipment, as well as some of these other issues. You know, voters just prior to your starting approved a renewed, a 3/8 cent sales tax. That gets you for 10 years funding public safety. Is that enough? Are there enough funds to do the kind of firefighting work that is necessary in KCK right now?
Yeah, I'm grateful for that renewal. Of course, just like firefighters, no chief's going to turn down additional funding
sure.
to buy apparatus. But we will be able to work with what we have to serve the citizens.
It sounds like more funding would always be welcome.
That's correct.
And new equipment is where you would put it first, or would it be other things?
New equipment, renovation of fire stations.
You know, you mentioned, we talked about a moment ago, that you went up through the ranks in Chicago. I wonder what you think the experience of a firefighter in KCK is compared to the experience of a Chicago firefighter. The certain culture is similar across the country, but there must be some differences.
Well, there are. There's some differences in terms of the amount of runs, of calls that are done here as opposed to Chicago. But fundamentally, the fire extinguishment, the technical rescue, the hazardous material mitigation, exactly the same here as it is in Chicago.
Have you found your favorite barbecue place?
I have been given a list of many barbecue places as I go around to the firehouses, and my wife and I are slowly ticking each one of them off.
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything a KCK fire chief is required to do. That's Mike Callahan. He's the new chief in KCK. Hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When we come back, if you're ready for an escape from reality, well, maybe our present reality at least, we will turn to our film critics for help. They'll have the latest in indie and documentary films, including looks at the world of rock climbing without ropes and making a life in America after the Holocaust. We'll have all of that after the break. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we found out what a proposed 8% property tax increase could mean for the Kansas City Public Library. Voters will approve or deny that bump on November 6th. You can hear our conversation at kcur.org/up to date. And then on Monday, Kansas Secretary of State and Republican candidate for Governor Chris Kobach will join us. Polls show him tied with Democratic candidate Laura Kelly. We'll get his thoughts on the race and what he would do as governor. But today, you've been getting an awful lot of talk these days about politics and politicians, including on these airwaves and on this program. Been hearing accusations and arguments and lies. Sometimes you just want to get away to some other part of the world, far from elections and candidates, somewhere with people and places you can immerse yourself in, learn something new, or just be entertained. Well, I'm getting laughs around the table already. We've brought in our emergency crew to help take us away. It's our film critics here to round up the month's documentary, Foreign and Independent Films, Not a Moment Too Soon. Hello, everyone.
Hi,
good
Brian.
Morning. Hi, Brian.
Film professor Cindy Haynes, good to have you back.
Thank you very much.
Steve Walker, as always.
Thank you.
And Bob Butler, whose reviews you can read at butlercinemascene.com. Hi, Bob.
Hey.
So you guys do this for a living. When the world is stressing you out, does going to film actually help?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Unless they're really horrible.
I was thinking that's the problem. On the other hand,
I recall someone saying, I hate my job. And I'm thinking, well, I'm on the way to see a movie. I really don't want to, but there's a guy digging a ditch over there. I can do it.
Yeah, you can do it.
Well, then without further ado, we should get started. Although I have to admit with this first film that this one would actually stress me out more than politics, I think. It's called Free Solo. It's a documentary about one of the most extraordinary athletic accomplishments of all times. Cindy, walk us through this carefully.
Well, in 2017, the 33-year-old free solo climber, Alex Honnold, scaled the 3,000-foot sheer granite face of Yosemite's El Capitan without ropes or safety gear of any kind. What an accomplishment. It was directed by Jimmy Chin and his wife Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli, and they had made a film several years ago called Meru about a group of elite climbers who attempted to scale the Himalayan big wall known as Meru. And it's an outstanding, considered one of the best adventure documentaries of all time. Well, this one tops that one.
Really?
Wow. And what's wonderful about it is that you really get a sense of who this guy Alex is and his compulsion and his passion. He's done over 1,000 free solo climbs in his life.
He is interesting because one slip of his hand or his toe.
He dies.
Right.
And the film crew even talks about that. They talk about what-if scenarios. And his backstory is he says he was a very melancholic kid, not close to his parents. He said he had to learn how to hug when he was 23 because it was so foreign to him. This is a sad person.
Right.
But it's an extraordinary accomplishment, and your fear of heights would get you in the pit of your stomach.
Right. I'll tell you what, there's a wonderful moment in there where he goes to a neurologist who does a CAT scan of his brain, and apparently his fear centers are like turned way down,
right.
Which there's actually a physiological reason why he's not scared to death.
Well, it strikes me that just for the filmmakers, like you start making this movie and you really don't know how it's going to end.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, in the middle of his climb up El Capitan, there's a guy on the valley floor with a camera following him, you know, for telephoto lens, and the guy finds he can't look through the lens finder because he's so scared, and he says, it's the last time I do one of these.
Right.
That's the cameraman.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any movie made today without drones. This is the perfect example of how useful drones can be in creating drama in a documentary.
We are going to hear a little clip from this film. What are we hearing?
Yeah, he keeps a notebook with almost virtually every movement of his fingers and his toes.
All right, let's listen.
From there, either karate kick or double dyno to an edge on the opposite wall. In some ways, it makes more sense to do the big two-handed jump because you're jumping to a good edge, so there's actually something to catch. But the idea of jumping without a rope seems completely outrageous. If you miss it, that's that.
Yes. Even
what
the
an
sound,
attitude, yes.
Even the sound of it is scary.
He has one more phrase that's interesting. He says, I have no concerns about, quote-unquote, maximizing life.
It's incredible. Wow. It's at the Tivoli. Opens today.
And switching to something of a very different kind of terror and a much more serious kind of terror, a documentary featuring six women who survived the Holocaust and started their lives again in America. Bob, tell us about After Auschwitz.
Well, it's made by John Keane, who about 12 years ago did a documentary called Swimming in Auschwitz, in which he interviewed these same six women. They had survived the Holocaust. They had ended up in America. They told their story of what it was like to be a woman in the camps. Now, After Auschwitz does something that very, very few Holocaust movies have done. Your typical Holocaust movie gets all of its, you know, emotional mileage out of smokestacks and Nazi jackboots and, you know, dead bodies. He has taken these women and created a story of what happened after the liberation. And in many ways, it's just as dramatic. For instance, you're liberated, but the armies that have come to liberate you are woefully ill-prepared to deal with the psychological, physical, even dietary needs of people who've been starving to death for years. The women end up robbing German homes and breaking into stores, trying to find something to eat. Some of them go back to their original towns, only to be find that all their property is confiscated, people are killing them, and they return to Germany because life in a displaced person's camp is preferable to that. There is a lot going on here that I knew nothing about.
Well, and then it takes them to America is the dream.
And you think everything's going to be better.
It becomes a common theme. And for many of them, do really well here. One becomes a famous clothing designer and does quite well. A couple interesting things, when they get to America, one of them has a son who wants to join the Boy Scouts. And she sees the uniforms and she's like, no. This looks too close
to Hitler youth,
too Nazi youth for me. You're not joining the Boy Scouts. So there's some dark humor in this, too. And the ladies are just really fascinating.
Yeah, John's done an excellent job of telling this story.
We're going to hear a little of the story. What are we hearing?
Well, let's see. What have we got here?
Two of the women are reflecting on how difficult it was to talk about their experience to their children.
All right. This is from After Auschwitz.
My children never asked questions, and I never told them. I remember there was some program on television, and they were quite young, and I made them watch it.
It's very hard for certain people to tell their young ones about their awful life. They have certain secrets. Not everything can you share with your loved ones.
I never much talked about the whole experience, but Paulette always had Jewish friends. You absorb it if you're not dumb.
I think they just lived in our house and breathed it in.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Yes, John Keane is going to be at Screenland. Was it, Steve, tonight?
He's doing today, 3 o'clock show, 5:10 show. There'll be a Q&A afterwards with him, and also tomorrow at 2 and 4:15.
If you have time, do go see it.
That's the Screenland, you said, right?
That's yes. The one in the Crossroads, yes.
Very good. So that film is called After Auschwitz. Next up, a different sort of dystopia. A writer in dystopian London finds his muse in a woman who has premonitions of her own murder. Steve, tell us about London Fields.
Well, I'll tell you briefly because I don't want to give it a whole lot of time. It's one of the worst things I've seen in a long, long time.
Wow.
Even though it's based on a novel by Martin Amis, a very well-respected writer, this thing has been sitting on the shelf since Johnny Depp was married to Amber Heard, this female woman who's an actor, supposedly,
that
he was married to. Johnny Depp has a cameo in it, uncredited. Yes, she shows up. Three men are so taken and bewitched by her beauty and intoxicating something that they fall in with her, and she says up front, "I know who's going to kill me," and then so it leads up to you, if you have any interest in it at all, who might be the killer? Billy Bob Thornton, Jim Sturgess, or Theo James? None of those questions are worth being answered.
Do you care is the question.
Not a drop.
Wow. Do you all share Steve's poor assessment of this film?
Yes.
Blessedly, I have not been subjected to it.
And well, we warned him.
Again, the emphasis is New York Times agrees with this from their review this morning, which is not always the case. It's been sitting on a shelf that is code for no one wants to release this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tarnished
That'll just lose money. Yeah.
Tarnish, not diamond. What's the rhinestone?
All there right. So if any of our listeners are prepared to subject themselves to what you've said would be
they
a terrible
may.
Experience.
It's playing at 5 screens in Kansas City. It opened right. today. Will not be there after Thursday, I predict.
Well, there you go. So get it while you can, if you want to. next up is a very dark satire about a family divided by politics gathering for Thanksgiving dinner. It's The Story of My Family. No, it's The Oath by...
Unfortunately, it's Left Town, and we're always facing this issue as to whether or not to review something that people can't see, and that's the case with The Oath.
So it came out last week, and it's already gone.
It came out last week, and that's the case with a lot of the films we talk about. They come and go. There was one that opened last week, had we done the show, called Thunder Road. At Screenland. It was terrific.
Wonderful movie.
It was
yeah.
on Cynthia and I's mm-hmm. 3 to see.
But it's also gone.
It's gone.
Yeah. If folks find it, and you can, of course, find films in other ways these days.
In a few weeks, you will be able to find it at Redbox or wherever else.
What do they need to know about The Oath, Bob?
Bob, you want to just describe
Well, very
it?
Briefly, a guy whose face you know but whose name you never did. It's Ike Barinholtz, I believe is how it's
yes.
pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
He's a triple threat. He wrote, directed, and stars in a movie about a suburban couple who are faced with a decision. The President of the United States has instituted something called the Patriot's Oath. People are given a year to sign up for it. It will go into effect the day after Thanksgiving, traditionally known as Black Friday.
Right.
And it's about the Thanksgiving dinner that this family has on the eve of this particular Black Friday, where everybody has to draw their line in the sand,
it's
as it were.
It's the nightmare of all Thanksgiving
well,
dinners.
Well, let's face it. Every Thanksgiving dinner is hellish. This just ups the ante because they're arguing about who has signed and who hasn't and what's going to happen to you if you don't.
Wow. And Tiffany Haddish has a small part in it, and she does a very good job as a straight actress. She's not playing
a comedian
in this.
Yeah.
No.
It's a movie whose time has come. I wish it was still around. I actually said in my review, it looks upon liberals as idiots and conservatives as idiots, which means that the whole family can wince through it.
All right. Well, since you've now made it sound like actually a pretty great movie, let's listen to just a few seconds of it. Here's a clip from The Oath.
If these bring up The Oath, I'm going to lose my mind, okay? I'm sure they're all about it. And if they go there, I will drop some.
No, you won't. You want to know why? Because I will drop some on you, and I don't even know what the that means. Can we just chill?
We all need to chill now.
We all need Tiffany Haddish right. around in a pinch, I think.
That's The Oath. So if you want to see it, maybe you can find it somewhere other than Kansas City. Next up is one that is playing in Kansas City.
Yes, it is.
It's called Tea with Dames. It's a documentary, Cindy, that features four preeminent British grand dames of the stage and screen.
Very good.
Reminiscing and Gossiping. My favorite movie so far this year.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's in a category all by itself. But Maggie Smith, Judi Dench, Joan Plowright, Eileen Atkins are hilarious. But they provide a story about decades of great acting, great theater, great film. And they're hilarious. They're absolutely hilarious.
They really are funny. And they obviously have had relationships with each other for years and years and years. Only in the last few minutes, though, do we get to see the champagne open. I kind of wish we'd seen it earlier.
You kind of wish they'd been drinking earlier. It would have really taken the lid off.
It was directed by Roger Mitchell, who did Notting Hill and My Cousin Rachel.
But also interesting, I mean, Maggie and Judi Dench are known to more people than Plowright and Eileen Atkins. But they're all dames from the Queen, and it's all takes place at Plowright was married to Laurence Olivier, and it takes place at their home where they raise their children.
I have to say, from the description of four people sitting around talking, reminiscing, it doesn't seem as gripping as you're describing.
They have great stories to tell, though, Steve, don't they? I mean,
it's not gripping in that sense, though, but it's. If you can imagine Judi Dench, one of the great actresses of all time, talking about how to this day, if she's in a new play, she will have no confidence and be nervous every night. I mean, you think, wow,
for anyone
really?
who wants to be involved in theater, is involved in theater, you really should see this movie.
There were some interesting revelations. All four of these actresses in their youth had been offered the role of Cleopatra, and all had turned it down, believing they weren't sexy enough to pull it off.
Oh, yeah. That kind
I
of
mean, that's a real insight into the actor's world.
Yes, and it's showing at the Tivoli, and I want to say. But we do have a clip.
Yeah,
and it's at the Glenwood as well.
What are we hearing, Cindy?
They're typical chatter.
Okay, just so you can decide for yourself if this is what you want to hear. This is from Tea with Dames.
If we're asked, we're going to work forever if we're asked.
Jenny. But you're always asked first, if I may say so. I'm turning on you now. It's all coming out now.
One of my hearing aids has gone. What have we just done?
Do you want one of mine? Do you want one of mine?
I know it won't fit. It's just what was the last thing said.
Are we going to go on working forever, Joan?
Oh, was that it?
And I said Jude gets all the parts first.
Oh, yeah. I tell you, my agent in America said to me when he knew I couldn't do very much because of the eyesight going, and he said, well, if you do want to come over again, we'll look around for a nice little cameo that Judi Dench hasn't got her paws on.
Okay.
That's how funny it is.
I admit I am charmed by it.
Charming.
Joan Plowright, people may know her as the mother in Mary Poppins, right?
I have to say, I mean, some of the live theater I've seen in my life, I've spent a lot of time in London, and I've seen all of these women on stage. In different ways, each experience was its own treasured memory for me and for my life. You know,
yeah, this is a theater geek's movie.
Oh, gosh. And I was a theater geek for many, many years.
Well,
so.
we have a room full of them here. So yes. It's great. Well, that film, again, Tea with Dames, opened at the Tivoli. And you said also
at the Glenwood.
Okay.
Judi Dench has the best laugh. in the business.
Very good. Well, next up, a biopic about the French writer Sidonie Gabrielle Colette, playing at the Tivoli. Bob, it's called Colette.
Yes, it is. Well, Colette, her story, at least the story of her early life, reads kind of like a feminist manifesto in some ways. A country girl who falls for a man twice her age, a big city character from Paris. She goes to work. She learns about society. She learns about sex from him. She learns about drinking from him. She learns how to be a sophisticate. And he's a writer. I'm trying to figure out. He has all sorts of magazines. He writes under the name Willie. And he hires starving writers to write things. He puts his names on them and sells them that way. And he starts doing this with his wife's writing as well. Colette eventually, played by Keira Knightley very well, by the way, wants her own name on her own material. Mm-hmm. What keeps this from being strictly a feminist, screed, if you will, is that her husband, Willie, is played by
Dominic West.
Dominic West, an actor who rarely gets the credit he deserves, and he makes this fellow so charming that you understand why she stuck with him as long as she did.
We're going to hear a little of this film. What are we listening to?
Well, this is Dominic West basically ranting about how broke they are, and maybe if his wife would write, they could, pull themselves out of this hole.
All right, this is from Colette.
How could we spend so much money?
The mortgage, Mathilde, restaurants.
You always pick up the bill, Willie, no matter how many people join us.
It's expected of me.
And the races and the casino.
What do you want me to do? Live like a monk or a peasant?
No, I'm just saying that we could economize.
You could write.
What?
Those stories you told me of Saint-Sever last year.
My school stories?
Yes, that could be Willie's next novel. Well, try it anyway, but try now. Start immediately. Aim for 4 hours at a time. The wolves are at the door!
That's from Colette.
I will say, too, that it does deal with the writing, but then their marriage takes an interesting turn, and at his urging, she begins a relationship with a woman.
Because a woman doesn't threaten him.
Maybe that is why. And she takes to, nightly, meaning, takes to wearing very masculine clothes. She becomes a sensation, the toast of Paris, when some of her writing is staged in the... what's that period? The Belle Epoque? Is it that long ago?
Sure, yes. And people know her probably as the author of Gigi, which was made into a film later.
But. Well, it's interesting. This only takes her up to about the age of 30. You could do a sequel to this about her later life.
I wish they had. This is the backstory. how she got to where she was. But she accomplished incredible things afterwards, and I thought, I wanted to see more of that in this film.
You don't actually see her become sort of the woman of letters she is later
not past 30, because Knightley couldn't do it, but
yeah,
she does a very good job. She's sort of underrated, I think.
Yeah, and I think if you're into costume drama, this is a lush recreation of that period in Parisian history.
I see an Oscar nomination for clothes, for sure. And set design.
All right, that's Colette playing at the Tivoli. One more film that's in theaters now in the area. Steve, it's called The Old Man and the Gun, about a gentleman bank robber who can't give up his life of crime, and the gentleman bank robber in question is really why people would see this film, right?
It's Robert Redford, who has said this is his last film.
And then he took it back.
Yeah, so he took it back. It's like Cher's, you know, a never-ending farewell tour. So,
right. Well, that's an only time Robert Redford and Cher have been compared.
I wouldn't say that. So he plays this real life true story. The Forrest Tucker was his name, not the actor from F Troop. But he robbed banks all the time just for the sheer thrill of it.
17 of them.
And he was arrested how many of those
17
times? And put in jail 17 times. Mm-hmm. So we meet him sort of in the twilight of his career. Redford's what, 82?
82, yeah.
He's in his 70s in this film, and, you know, it's still at it, still in the game. What happens is he meets a woman that makes him think about settling down, played by the always kind of luminous Sissy Spacek, who we haven't seen for a while. But there are cops on his trail, chiefly Casey Affleck, who coincidentally was in two of the director David Lowery's last films, A Ghost Story and Ain't Their Bodies Saints. And Casey Affleck, I think, has had some issues, but I think he's a terrific actor.
You say the bank robber in the story still has got it. Does Robert Redford still got it?
Well, I thought this might come up. let me say it this way. I've never thought Robert Redford was a terrific actor, never.
A good director, but not a good actor.
He is a movie star, for sure. And some of his films that he's in, All the President's Men, The Way We Were, I mean, those are things you can watch over and over and over. The Candidate, mm-hmm. there's a lot of them. Butch Cassidy, you know, if you're into Westerns.
But,
I mean, he's fine. He's never been anything but fine to me. I don't know, Bob or Cindy?
I'm totally unimpressed with his performance. I really thought it was almost sad. Sissy Spacek is wonderful in it, and I thought the comparison here between the styles, the skills, the talents, it's not comparable.
Actually, I think he was much more impressive in All Is Lost, playing a man alone on a boat that's sinking.
That was good. That's right. I forgot about that one.
A couple things. We're going to hear a clip, but the script is really not doing anyone any favors. There's when he and Spacek first meet, she says, I have three horses. And he says, what are their names? And her response is, who? The horses. And I just thought, this is so dumb. What's interesting, though, for me, was David Lowery's decision to film this in a style that could have been shot in 81, and we're just seeing it. It's really grainy. Hmm. I think the set and production design are really, really on point. It's kind of like love-hate, but I don't hate it, but I don't love it.
Give us a sense of what we're about to hear.
We're going to hear shortly after Robert Redford and Sissy Spacek meet, he's kind of hinting about what he does for a living or might do.
All right. This is from The Old Man and the Gun.
So what'd be worse, if I'm lying about this or telling you the truth?
Prove it.
You want me to prove it?
Yeah.
Well, what do you do if I can't?
I won't walk out that door.
No, I'm not gonna do it.
I didn't think so.
Not because I can't. Because it's just not my style.
So he's taken it back that this may not be his last film, Cindy?
Yes, he has.
Cindy, you're a woman.
Yeah, yes.
Redford. I have friends who have always thought Redford was
I've never found him to be all that attractive.
Really?
I really didn't, and certainly not a dynamic actor.
And not with Warren Beatty as a peer.
Yeah. Yeah, we could go down there. Right. Anyway,
that rabbit hole.
So before we, that was The Old Man and the Gun. It's playing at the Tivoli. You can still see it. We're going to move away from that subject.
And, thank you.
One other thing we have to move back to when we talked about Joan Plowright a minute ago. We got some bad information, but in fact, Joan Plowright was not playing the mother of Mary Poppins. That was Glynis Johns. So we got a correction from a listener about that.
Okay.
Sorry.
It wasn't. It didn't come from you guys. It was our fault. So we've talked about all of these films, and we've already mentioned that sometimes films come and go even before people get a chance to see them from Kansas City.
Absolutely.
But one place that films seem to be going more and more often is not to screens at all, but rather to Netflix. We are at a time where billions and billions of dollars are being invested in new films, but they're not coming to screens, Cindy.
Literally billions. Netflix borrowed another $2 billion just recently to add to the $8 billion they are already spending on original programming, original television series, and original movies. And this week, it was just sort of stunning to find out, in fact, that these are Netflix original films: Private Life with Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn.
Terrific.
The Kindergarten Teacher with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Riveting.
The 22nd of July, a reenactment of the 2011 terrorist attack in Norway. The Land of Steady Habits with Ben Mendelsohn, Edie Falco, and Connie Britton. The Coen Brothers' next film is coming out on Netflix and not in the movie theater initially.
So what do we make of this? Well, I mean, you're saying,
very
Steve,
mixed feelings.
They're excellent films.
They're excellent films. They are opening in New York and L.A. on
to
screens.
To qualify for awards, yeah.
And Netflix just has all that money. Not that they created The Kindergarten Teacher, but they certainly bought it. They provided some funding in order for it to get released. Do we love our independent art houses here in town? Of course we do. That's why we've done this show for as many years as we have. Do I enjoy seeing a new Maggie Gyllenhaal movie the day it comes out in New York on my big screen TV? Absolutely, I do.
So this is not an entirely bad development, but you have mixed feelings, Bob.
Yeah, you do have mixed feelings. One thing we have forgotten in our increasingly digital society is that the dramatic arts are supposed to be a communal thing. Mm. And you lose that. Now, granted, your fellow theater goer can hack you off something fierce, right, tapping your chair, crunching their eyes,
checking their texting.
Texting.
Yeah. In this great world of ours, one of the few things in the world, few things are as satisfying as watching a movie, somebody says something funny, and there's a period of about 2 seconds while it sinks in, and then everybody laughs at once. It is one of the most liberating feelings in the world, and you don't get that sitting in your easy chair with a beer.
You don't. And scary movies had the same effect. I still remember seeing Carrie in college and the communal gasp in the ending scene of that film. I wouldn't have got that sitting at home with a glass of Shiraz in front of my computer screen.
I mean, with Amazon Prime and HBO and Showtime making independent films now.
Exactly. They are too.
This is the way of the future, I'm
afraid.
And right?
the upside is that these are good films. These are films that don't depend on an 18-year-old buying a ticket at the box office to be a success. They're paid for in advance, and they can go places that commercial theatrical films can't.
And Netflix has so much power right now. They don't have to report. They have some deal where they don't report how many people watch it, whatever.
We'll have to leave it there, but maybe we'll have to start reviewing Netflix films.
I think we've thought about it, actually.
Film professor Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, Bob Butler, thanks to all of you for being here.
Yes,
thank
sir.
Thank you, Brian.
Always a pleasure. Yesterday on the program, some cities in Kansas are considering non-discrimination laws for LGBTQ people, but not everyone thinks they're necessary. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. And I'm at PTS Brian. Don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook, too. Next week, Steve Kraske's back in this chair, and he'll talk with political commentator and former presidential advisor David Gergen about his time in and out of the White House. That theme music's composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Coy Duggar, Jean-Vive Desmarteau, Steven Steigman, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Reed. A lot of help. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend, everyone. And you are up to date.